Hey there, welcome to Making Positive Psychology Work, the weekly podcast where we uncover tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, so together we can better navigate the incredible challenges and opportunities our world faces. I'm your host, Michelle McQuaid, and what you probably don't know about me is that I get my inspiration from amazing women like Amy Pallier, Claire Bowditch, and Sarah Bareilles. Oh yeah. Thank you so much for joining me for lesson number 41 of Making Positive Psychology Work. I'm so glad you're here because today we're talking to Dacca Keltner, a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center. Dacca's research focuses on the biological and evolutionary origins of compassion, awe, love, beauty, power, social class, and inequality. He's the co-author of two textbooks, Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and The Compassionate Instinct. And his new book is The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Dacca has published over 190 scientific articles, written for many media outlets, and consulted for Google, Facebook, the Sierra Club, and for Pixar's Inside Out. But what you probably don't know about Dacca is that he gets his inspiration from backpacking, volunteering in prison, and Iggy Pop. Welcome, Dacca.
It's great to be with you, Michelle.
It's a pleasure to be talking with you today because I've just recently finished reading The Power Paradox, and boy, do I have a lot of questions for you. So let's start at the beginning for our listeners and get clear on what exactly is power.
So power, and this is a really complicated task to try to figure out what a broad social construct is like power, but I think the most parsimonious and powerful way to define power is that it is your capacity to influence other people. And so what that does for us is it tells us that, A, power isn't what you might think of it as, is, you know, it's money or your title or so forth. It really is just your capacity to alter the lives of other people. And then B, what it tells us, this definition that comes out of sociology and social psychology, is that really, power is everywhere, right? It is not just at work. It is not just on the battlefield. It is not just in politics, but really there are power dynamics between friends and romantic partners and in families. We all knew this, but the science of power has just arrived at that more recently. And so that definition helps us understand how important power is in our lives.
I have to confess that the idea that power is actually about being able to influence other people, and as you talk about in the book, particularly influence other people's to make a difference in the world, had me really sitting up and wanting to understand how I could gain power for the first time in my life. So based on your research, how are you finding we gain power?
Well, I'm glad you had that reaction, Michelle, because, you know, it's funny. Sometimes power is almost a dirty word, right? Like, she just wants to have power, right? But in point of fact, and one of the things that I do in The Power Paradox is I talk about a lot of amazing people who have changed the world in surprising ways through their power. You know, people like Thomas Clarkson, who wrote an essay about the horror of slavery and slave ships, and that led to the abolition of slavery. So how we get power is this fundamental question, and it turns out it really matters because power, when you feel like you can influence others and shape their lives, you actually are happier, you're healthier, you feel more connected to the world. So it's a good thing to want. And how we get power, and this has been studied in organizations and in schoolyards and in military units, sports teams, presidents in the United States, we get power by connecting to other people. We get power by lifting up the welfare of other people, by enhancing their lives. We get power through empathy and really knowing and feeling what other people are knowing and thinking and feeling. We get power by being bold. You know, I think it's so important for women who are often better at a lot of these skills that get you power, like empathy, but just to also be bold, right? To lean in, to speak your mind. So we get power by being kind. So there are a lot of ways in which we get power by building up strong social networks.
I think that's so interesting that there are often those small things that we can be doing. And I love your example there about the way that women in particular get power. I do a lot of work with female leaders. And I agree. I think, you know, naturally, you know, women are pretty good at connecting. We're good at enhancing lives, the empathy, the being kind, but we struggle with the being bold quite often in my experience.
I agree.
So, Dacca, how do we be more bold so that we can have the influence in the world that we're capable of having?
Well, you know, and I teach women in leadership positions too, and this, I think this is one of the central problems, right? I think there are two problems for women they face in the power world. And one is outdated stereotypes. We used to think, and a lot of people still do, oh, women don't quite make the great leaders. And actually, there are a lot of data coming out of organizations and government showing women actually may be better at leadership than men. And then the second problem is, to, like you said, Michelle, is to be bold, right? And so there are studies, and I think this is why Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, was so resonant for women, which is just remind yourself in the everyday interactions where power is at play, at work and in your family and in organizations, just to speak up, right? Lean in, ask questions, don't be quiet, right? There's a lot of power in being quiet and thoughtful, and that's the essence in some sense of good power. But just remind yourself that as a habit, make sure that you're letting your views known, offer bold ideas. These are things that men can tend to do a little bit more sort of reflexively. And so women should do that too.
So Professor Amy Cuddy, in her best-selling book, Presence, features a lot of your research around power. And she suggests perhaps one of the ways we can improve our feelings of personal power is by expanding our body into power poses. And she points to hundreds of studies about how that body-mind effect can actually shape the way we perceive ourselves and then the way we interact with others. So how do those findings sit alongside your definition of power? And as I was reading the book and thinking about this, your definition of power seemed anchored so much more in the social, in how other people perceive us, and perhaps a little less in that individual piece about how we perceive ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, Amy's research was, and I profile it in the book, was one of these light bulbs that went off. And I think it has this theme of there are small things you can do on a minute-by-minute basis that will get you power, right? You can speak your mind. You can ask a great question. You can hold your body, as Amy's research shows, in a more upright, expansive way instead of slouching or slumping your shoulders and the like. You can be mindful of your tone of voice. You can be mindful that you shouldn't. Women are more sophisticated at speaking in a polite fashion. It actually takes a lot of cognitive sophistication to be a polite speaker. But sometimes politeness can feel a little apologetic, right? Mm. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't mean this, and I'm sorry about that. So be mindful of those things that might take away from the sense that you have confidence and power. Those are things we can keep track of all the time, just as, you know, Michelle, when I'm interacting with my students and colleagues, you know, I'm older, I have a high power position, I'm kind of big, I have a loud voice. I make sure I quiet my body to empower other people, right? I get smaller. I look at their eyes. I use a softer tone of voice. And that's being mindful in another direction. So there are small things you can do. And you're absolutely right. Really, the power paradox is about social power. It is about your power with other people, whether they're your kids, your romantic partners, your best friends, or people at work. But today, more so than 500 years ago, power is social. We have to get along with other people to do good work at work. So I think you're right to emphasize the social dimension of the book.
And so the other thing that was coming to mind as I was reading it was perhaps how those findings around the social power that we can cultivate might intersect with the findings of researchers like Professor Adam Grant around givers rising to the top in workplaces, but also potentially going to the bottom when they don't know how to use that social interaction well.
Yeah, you know, there's this Adam's work, Adam Grant at Wharton, was really influential in my thinking, you know, that you get all these, just by saying thank you as a leader, the people you're managing do better. By sharing resources, you actually empower your team to do better work. All the pro-social stuff is starting to reveal itself to be an important basis of power. And I write about that in the power paradox, which is that there are a lot of reasons why generosity and gratitude and empathy and kindness are a basis of enduring power. But you have to watch out, right? You have not to get exploited. You have to make sure that your giving and generosity is attuned to the people you're working with and the context, because there is the opportunity for exploitation. So you have to have a little bit of skepticism built into it.
Sounds like a healthy balance. The other thing that fascinated me about power that I'd never fully appreciated was the way that it could trigger our psychological and behavioural approach or our inhibition systems when we're feeling powerless. So can you talk to us a little bit about what you found in the research about how feelings of power shape the way we're showing up in different situations?
Thank you. You know, you got right, Michelle, to the heart of my theoretical argument and that of my colleagues. So the power paradox is really, a lot of people have written about power economically or in terms of politics and who votes, right, or on the military battlefield. And people psychologists hadn't really worked through systematically, like, wow, what is my mind doing when I have power? How does it affect my emotions? Right? How does it affect how I see the world or how I speak or how close I feel to other people? And those are always the questions that psychologists have been interested in. And so we started to do this work, and it really began in an interesting sort of accidental observation where I was studying shame and embarrassment, which are very inhibited, submissive emotions. And I saw these people get, in laboratory research, become embarrassed and ashamed, and their bodies would get small, and they'd look away, and their tone of voice would get really constrained, and they'd blush, and they'd sort of tighten up their body. And I thought, wow, that looks like the subjective state of not having power, right? Mm-hmm. And that led me, and this was 25 years ago when I was working with Paul Ekman, to the idea that feeling powerless, you know, much like the very poor, struggling kids I grew up around in the country of California, it inhibits all of your behavior and your emotions, and actually as a result of cortisol and other stress-related processes. And then complementarily, I did this study of kind of fraternity guys in the United States joking around and telling stories about each other, and the high-power guys were totally disinhibited. They were sitting relaxed. They were swearing, they were laughing, their voice sounded really loud and relaxed, right? The pleasures they were experiencing really strongly registered in their face. I was like, wow, power, when you have power, it's really simple. It's not necessarily unethical. It's really about, I get to do whatever I want, and I will go after the rewards that seem really gratifying, and I'll pursue my self-interest, and I'll act impulsively. And that simple idea of approach being at the core of having power and inhibition being at the core of not having power guided thousands of studies.
And one of the things that was a big aha moment for me was that in your studies, you're finding that when we feel powerful, we're more attuned to opportunities, but when we're feeling powerless, we're more attuned to threats. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, and that's right at the core of the psychology of social power, you know, which is that when you feel powerful, let's say you do really well at work, or you have a great meal with your kids, or you win a prize in a volunteer organization, or if something goes really well and you're feeling empowered, right, and your body expands, what's happening in the mind is the mind suddenly feels free of social constraints, and it's saying, what are the good things in this environment that I can go after, right? Now, what's interesting, Michelle, and Anna Gwinnett has done really nice work on this, which is that when I feel powerful, I can identify what's most rewarding in the environment. And often that's a good thing. Like, hey, this is a great opportunity for our organization to be working on. And power sharpens your focus on rewards. The trouble is when it sharpens your focus on all your selfish rewards, right? Mm-hmm. Ooh, there's somebody I want to flirt with. Or, hey, I want that money. I'll take that money. Or, that's my food. I'm hungry. I'll eat the food off somebody's plate. You know, and that becomes problematic. So it does sharpen your focus on rewards. And then the other side is when people don't feel powerful, they're very aware of risks, right? They're like, oh, that's going to be dangerous. We may make a mistake there. That'll lead to problems. And it's good to have people in that mindset in every organization. This investment has risks, and it's important to know that. So you want, as always, a balance of power and then the world, the lens of not having power.
Now, I'm a huge advocate of understanding how some of these good ideas have risks or downsides, and it was one of the things that intrigued me in your research, and particularly where your findings were that while we gain and maintain power through empathy, but that we also, you know, in the experience of power can lose our focus on others and end up abusing the power that they've given to us. So can you help us understand how this power paradox is working?
You know, this was such a striking narrative arc, and I think it's, you know, I think this arc is one of the great arcs in every person's life and in their career and in their romantic partnerships and in history, which is we get power. You know, our kids will follow our words. Our partners will be kind to us. The people at work will give us status and opportunity when we enhance the welfare of other people. You know, when we listen and when we empathize and we share and we show gratitude. But once we feel powerful and the surges of approach and positive emotion and even mania are kind of running through us, we abandon those practices. We stop listening. We stop paying attention to people carefully. We stop sharing. We start hoarding things. A couple of really good examples. There are studies that show in really tightly controlled laboratory studies, if I'm in a group, and I share resources with other people, like, hey, I've got this extra resource, here you go, and I start sharing, other people will follow me. But once I feel powerful, if I'm in that same group, I'm more likely to keep more of the resources to myself, right? Mm-hmm. Another set of studies. If I don't have power and I'm rising, I really listen to people carefully. I look at their eyes. I follow their expressions. I know what they're thinking. And I'm just savvier and more socially intelligent in how I behave. But then all kinds of studies show once I feel powerful, right? You give me a little bit of power in an experiment, I'm not as good at judging people's emotions from their facial expressions. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you what somebody said. I interrupt them more. So that's this paradox, which is we get power by good things and lose those good things once we have power. And I think it's something that we grapple with on a daily basis, really, when you think about it.
Absolutely. And I have to confess, the fear of losing my empathy for others is absolutely one of the things that in the past causes me to step back from the difference I might really be able to make in the world. So how do we navigate this power paradox to continue having the positive impact we want to have for others?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting, Michelle. When I started doing this work, you know, I'm mainly a lab scientist, although I teach a lot of leaders for 20 years. And it just resonated with this theme that you do your best work socially when you don't have power and you rise. And then suddenly you get comfortable and a little bit arrogant and too proud and you lose the edge in the social realm that got you power, right? The empathy and the gratitude and the other orientation. And people really press me like, you know, well, what do I do to keep that focus on other people? And in fact, I wrote an essay for the Harvard Business Review on that, where we really just worked through like, okay, how do I keep empathy? How do I listen effectively? And it's really, it boils down to things you can practice all the time, which is ask great questions, right? When somebody's speaking, use your body, like Amy Cuddy suggested, and your eyes and your voice to show, like, I am engaged with what you are saying. Think hard and test yourself, like, am I really taking in what's in somebody else's mind, or am I just trying to assert my own views? If you stay close to that, you'll be pretty good at the skill of empathy. Another one is gratitude and appreciation. You know, it's so interesting that when we have power, it's a privilege. We have this chance to make people's lives better, that there's no greater privilege in life than that. Yeah, so, you know, in that state, you're like, wow, I should remember that, and I should be appreciative of other people and say thank you and pat them on the back and recognize the good work they do and recognize how essential they are. That stuff is the very fabric of great leadership, and it's right there to be practiced every minute.
I know in the book in particular, you talk about the importance of practicing humility. And as you're describing those steps, that's kind of the thing that's staying in my mind about how do you stay connected with that humility? And I think it's a skill that often we don't fully understand. And as leaders, we don't always value. So is there anything else you'd recommend about how do we practice humility on a daily basis when we are in these powerful positions?
So, you know, it's interesting. And Michelle, I think you've just offered a radical hypothesis, right? Which is humility. When people talk about the great leaders, like what was it like in the United States? What was Abraham Lincoln like? You know, or for me, Charles Darwin, one of my intellectual heroes. Darwin was a very humble person. Lincoln was humble. Sheryl Sandberg works amidst her colleagues, right, in the same desk. It's an act of humility. And I think that what you said, I hope people will remember, which is that we tend to think of humility as like this genetic gift or what the Dalai Lama does, or it's a virtue that only some people have. But really, it's a practice, right? And so there are all these ways in which to practice humility, which is let other people speak before you speak. That is an act of deference. You can hold your body as a leader in a modest way, right? You can do things in your personal life that give you humility. One of the things my lab's really interested in, we have a lot of great data, is when you go out and you find awe, right, in nature or symphonies or the wonder of other people, and you feel awestruck, that makes you humble, right? And you are a better leader. I was struck working with Pete Docter on Inside Out, very humble genius. His films make $1 billion, right? He manages 250 people. He had this humility about him. And one of the things he did is he was always reaching out to other people who knew more than him to find out what's interesting. How can I sort of sharpen my mind? So there are a lot of ways in which we need to practice humility.
Beautiful. I think those are such beautiful tips to give us. And I was fascinated in your HBR article. You talk about the fact that studies have shown that people in positions of corporate power are three times as likely as those lower down the rung on the ladder to interrupt co-workers, to multitask during meetings, to raise their voices and say insulting things at the office, all kind of the opposite of humility. And so I was fascinated about how, as you go into workplaces, do you teach, you know, these ideas around the power paradox and perhaps the practices that leaders need to engage more effectively in?
That article, the HBR, How Not to Be Corrupted by Power, and then the practical material in the power paradox came out of 20 years of having really focused conversations with great leaders around the world, you know, from biotech to government, science. And what it would take the form of is, so it's really important to practice gratitude, as Ada Grant shows, right? Say thank you, show appreciation. So what do? And out would come these wonderful pieces of wisdom from people out in the field, like make sure you always put your coworkers' names on a presentation. Have awards for people and the work that they do. Visit their office. Send them a handwritten note. Cultivate a language of appreciation. Just on down the line. Have celebrations when somebody does really well. And bonuses and the like, just all this great wisdom, right? Working with leaders and seeing how they really, some of them, how they would practice empathy, how they would really, man, when they would listen, it was just full embodied listening, you know, that it was just this, it was almost like their physical exercise or their dietary regime to really implement it. So I think for each of these ethical principles of empathy and gratitude and humility and the like, and generosity, they're very simple, straightforward things to cultivate that I teach regularly.
Do you think the ideas of servant leadership are an intersection here for how we kind of keep the power paradox in check?
I do. There's this deep vein in the historical thinking about who are great leaders, right? That had I written a slightly different book, that would have been the central thesis. And I know Collins's book, The Good to Great, that's the core of it, is the last level of leadership is service and serving other people. And, you know, you find, Michelle, in hunter-gatherer societies, and I take an evolutionary view and we look at those data, that the people who have respect and esteem and power in hunter-gatherer societies basically serve others, right? They share, they protect, they assist, they cooperate. If you get to the study of great politicians, great political leaders have this service orientation where they have this vision of what they want to give to the collective, and that drives them. And then you get into our lives, in our families, and in our workplace, and there are data coming out that really gives you enduring power.
So at the end of the book, you write about your wish for a society where all people would have as much power as possible. And with a growing focus in organisations on inclusion, I hope we're kind of moving down that path. But what do you think the kind of workplace might really look like in the future? If we really shared power, how does work change?
Well, in part, it's been fascinating, Michelle, to teach here at Berkeley, you know, near Silicon Valley and all the incredible things that are happening. I've taught leaders for 20 years, both at Stanford and at Berkeley, and it is happening. And it's happening in this more greater empowerment in a few different ways. So what we wish for is happening. So there are many more women in leadership positions. And if I were to wish for one thing, that would probably be it, which is women, I think, will prove to avoid the abuses of power a little bit more effectively and lead in ways that are strong. So that's great. The workplace is so much more multicultural than ever before. You know, now when I teach, there are people from Southeast Asia and Latin America and just people. It's just much more diverse, although we need more diversity. And the work itself is, you know, in a lot of sectors is much more collaborative. And this is documented. It just takes more skills to get work done. So there it's more kind of mutually empowered. And what I now would hope for is a greater equality in compensation. That, you know, I write about this in The Power Paradox, and it is undeniable that we have greater economic inequality today than 30 or 40 years ago. And it's costing us in many ways. And so I'd wish for that.
Those sound like great wishes. Dakar, are you ready for the lightning round?
Yes.
So I'm fascinated of all the different pieces that you've researched. What is the most useful tool or learning you've applied in your own life and why?
I would say I have been blown away by the power of simple mindfulness. You know, I teach this in my happiness class at the Greater Good Science Center, just being aware. Just start with your breath, being aware of who you are in your body, and then your emotions, and then your struggles, and finding peace in mindfulness as the best antidote to stress. So that has been transformative for me. And then secondly, I would say, is find awe. Get out wherever you are, and twice a week, go find something that gives you goosebumps.
I love that idea. And if we take the power paradox as a given, is there a book that you'd particularly recommend when it comes to bringing out the best in people in workplaces?
Wow. I would say I'll give you two that really changed my life. And one was Franz De Waal, his book called Good Natured. And what Franz shows, he's a famous primatologist who studies chimpanzees and macaques and non-human primates, is non-human primates are cooperative and kind. And really, to lead in the non-human primate world, you have to practice that stuff. And when I read that, and he also wrote Chimpanzee Politics, it changed my thinking of power. Mm-hmm. And then I would recommend His Holiness the Dalai Lama, The Ethics for a New Millennium, just about secular approaches to being good to other people and how powerful. And I go to the Greater Good Science Center, even though I'm part of it. Every time I go there, I feel like, wow, I've learned something. It's all free and it makes us better to other people.
It's an incredible resource. Dakar, what are you reading right now and are you enjoying it?
Right now, I am reading William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, and I'm reading this strange book about how people collected wonderful artifacts in the 18th century, like strange animals and the like. And I'm very much enjoying them.
It sounds fascinating. What a contrast of two. I'm sure they're a good balance for each other. And lastly, there was one thing you wished everybody thought about when it came to applying ideas around positive psychology and well-being, the ideas from the greater good into workplaces. What would it be?
Well, I think if you focus on lifting up the happiness of other people, you're going to do okay. And to me, that is the central ethical insight that gets us to happiness and power.
Dakar, thank you so much for joining us today.
I wish all conversations were like this, Michelle. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
My absolute pleasure. And thank you for listening. For more information on Dacca's wonderful work, make sure you grab a copy of The Power Paradox. And we'll be sure to put a link for that book and the Greater Good website into the show notes for you. I highly recommend both. You've been listening to Making Positive Psychology Work with Michelle McQuaid. For the notes from today's show and more tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, be sure to head on over to michellemcquaid.com and grab our free wellbeing toolkit packed with how-to tips, tools, and interviews with the world's leading positive psychology researchers. And if you'd like to perform a random act of kindness today and lift your own power, then share this podcast with a friend or colleague to help improve our workplaces. After all, as Martin Luther King Jr. wisely said, life's most urgent question is, what are you doing for others? Until next time, take care.